I'm going to be speaking to you today about the relationship between time, historical consciousness, and cultural trauma in the study of Chinese modernization in post-war Taiwan. Dealing with this complicated relationship theoretically, my purpose is to show that historical narrative plays a very important role in people's understanding of the relationship between their individual fate and destiny, and the fate of destiny of a collectivity, such as social group, ethnic group, or a nation, and so on. My major argument is that the central discursive mechanism connecting individual identity to collective identity is typically a specific form of historical narrative. But let me explain my research question first and give some reasons why I chose to study this research question. We know that in 1945, Japanese colonialism in Taiwan ended, and the government of the Republic of China, controlled by the Chinese Nationalist Party, that is KMT, took over Taiwan and made it a province of the ROC, of the Republic of China. But just 4 years later, in 1949, because the KMT lost the civil war to the Chinese communists, the KMT government escaped from the Chinese mainland to Taiwan. Back at that time, the island of Taiwan, with a population of about 6 million, received more than 1 million mainland refugees. Since then, Taiwan began to go through a long period of minority rule under the KMT, dominated by the mainland. Before the transition to democracy began in the late 1980s, Taiwan had the longest period of rule by martial law in the world, that is 38 years. The island society suffered the white terror and the brutal political repression, mainly against the local Taiwanese people, Taiwanese dissidents. As many of you know, the authoritarian KMT government under Chiang Kai-shek claimed that Taiwan was free China, the only representative of all China, and promoting Chinese national identity and historical memory at the expense of Taiwanese counterparts. The KMT repeat its determination to retake the mainland, but the desire was never realized. By the end of the 1950s, the KMT had, if not completely, given up its military struggle for retaking the mainland. For many mainlanders in exile, their dream of returning home was nearly broken in the late 1950s. In post-war Taiwan, the social basis of promoting Chinese national consciousness was the single party authoritarian control and the so-called the Japanized and sanitized education and cultural restructuring under the KMT as a regime in exile. The modernization discourse imported from the West, especially the USA, became very popular since the late 1950s or the early 1950s or the early 1960s. This modernization discourse articulated with the historical narrative of Chinese national trauma in a very special way. This kind of articulation resulted in a context-specific nationalized discourse of modernization, which focuses on the problematic of why China, including Taiwan, as Free China, had a difficulty in modernizing itself. What kind of modernization China should pursue? How China should modernize itself in order to achieve national revival and so on. This kind of modernization discourse supported a very particular form of Chinese national consciousness, which was expressed in a series of dichotomies, such as China versus West, Chinese versus Western, something like this, or tradition versus modernization, and so on. As we know that ideas, ideologies, or even cultural imageries can generate social realities in their own right. During the period from 1960s to the 1980s, the Chinese modernization discourse had a major influence on people's understanding of their collective fate or destiny. This discourse was, I will call it, an interpretive matrix in which the KMT state, intellectuals, and even the masses addresses themselves to a variety of political, social, and cultural issues, like this article shows. These issues varied from school curriculum, or even something like language problem, farming, animal agriculture, community development, or banking, or even banking, or even garbage processing, something like this. They talk about this kind of thing under the framework of Chinese modernization. This discourse had a profound symbolic and material effects on post-war Taiwan. During these three decades, I mean from the 1960s to 1980s, the study of Chinese modernization was very popular across many disciplines, including history, sociology, political science, anthropology, psychology, and other research areas. During the three decades, Chinese modernization became the dominant problematic of various academic disciplines. Many scholars in humanities and social sciences devoted themselves to investigating the experience of Chinese modernization since the late 19th century. We can say that in general, these scholars belong to the first and second generation of mainland scholars in exile. The study of this subject, I mean Chinese modernization, was shaped not only by modernization theory that derived from the West. It was also characterized by a very strong Chinese nationalism, and thus became significant part of the political cultural discourse of Chinese modernization prevailing at that time. Here are some examples of the study of Chinese modernization in post-war Taiwan. During these three decades, maybe the book From Tradition to Modernity by Ambrose Pin, maybe the most influential work on this issue. His book is so influential, and at the beginning of his book, he dedicated his book to those who devoted themselves to the study of Chinese modernization. We have more examples like this. I mean, the prospects of Chinese culture by the very famous liberal Yin Hai Guang, or the Confucianism and the modernization, Chinese culture and modern life like this. Also, we have modernization and nationalism, modernization and sanitization, something like this, published in late, in the mid-1980s. Also, the Institute of Modernization, where the professor Zhang Zhejia come from, back at that time, published a series of researches on this topic about the, each province, I mean about the Chinese modernization in each province of China. So it's a huge project like this about Shandong and Fujian or Zhejiang and Taiwan. The very painful experience of, the very painful experiences of exile and refugee in Taiwan had a very profound influence on the personal and intellectual lives of two generations of mainland scholars. Almost without exception, they were deeply influenced by a Chinese cultural trauma. That is, very painful memories and strong sentiments about a China that, ever since the late 19th century, suffered from various domestic troubles and the continuing oppression and humiliation by foreign powers. They were very sorry about the fate of modern Chinese, modern China, because it was surrounded by various difficulties and its people suffered serious poverty. These mainland scholars usually show a distinctive Chinese nationalism and hoped that through modernization, China could catch up with the advanced world powers. In general, their research about the pragmatic issue of Chinese modernization was characterized by an integration of two temporal frameworks. That is, the history of the global transition from tradition to modernity, and the history of the transition from tradition to modernity in China. These two temporal frameworks were externalized, were embodied into a specific form of narrative about the global and the Chinese history of modernization in their respective researches. The focus of my presentation today will be the sociological research on Chinese modernization conducted by Long Guanhai, a mainland exile and one of the major founders of Taiwanese sociology. I take him as an example of the first and the second generation exiled mainland scholar in post-war Taiwan. But before I move on to discuss Long's case, I would like to explain a little bit about my conceptual and the theoretical frameworks about the relationship between narrative, time, and the human understanding of fate and destiny. First, I want to make it clear what I mean by narrative or story. Since the 1980s, internationally, there have been a remarkable development of narrative studies across different disciplines and fields, which has been described as the so-called the narrative turn. Although some researchers argue that there's a difference between narrative and story, but many use these two concepts interchangeably to mean basically the same thing. So if I will just follow the majority's way to use them interchangeably. There are different definitions of narrative, but what they have in common is that these different definitions take a narrative as a form of discourse that places events in a sequential order with a clear beginning, middle, and end. when seeing an event or a group of events as having an order in terms of beginning, middle, and the end, gives it or them a plot. And a plot is the major, is the most important feature of narrative. In plot method, or so-called plot making, is the key to give a narrativity to the to an account of or of an event. Implotment or plot making turns an event into an episode in a larger story. It also gives independent cases a meaning by linking them into a larger story. But as a means of giving order and a meaning to events, narrative is not simply the reflection of reality. The act of narration gives events a clear beginning, middle, and end, using mechanisms such as selection, recombination, simplification, and so on, to make events into a coherent story. Narrative or storytelling is so universal in human society. It is essential in social life. The prevalence and the importance of narrative arises mainly from the fundamental temporal or historical dimension of human existence. The experience and the interpretation of life is always temporal. The way people actually experience time is not only as physical time, that is, not only as a series of precise conventional units like seconds, minutes, hours, days, months, and years. As far as the construction of individual or collective identity is concerned, more important is the fact that people experience time in momentary present, in awareness of the past, and the future. The human activity of narrative and the temporality or historicity of human experience is very closely related. Narrative shows people's spatial way of experiencing time in a very special way. I will just quote the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur. He argues that in his first volume of Time and the Narrative, quote, time becomes human to the extent that it is articulated through a narrative mode, and the narrative attains its full meaning when it becomes a condition of temporal existence, unquote. In Ricoeur's analysis, the element of narrativity most related to its temporal significance is precisely plot. In other words, narrative organizes people's experience into a series of meaningful episodes in time. As a fundamental human system of making sense of the world, narrative is a major way by which human time or social time is constructed. Sociologist Antony Giddens once pointed out that, quote, self-realization implies the control of time. Holding a dialogue with time is the very basis of self-realization, unquote. I argue that this kind of dialogue is typically embodied into narrative about identity. The central importance of narrative is the construction, in the construction of identity represents humans' attempt to control individual or collective fate or destiny unfolding in time by defining and redefining it. As a strategy to control fate or destiny, narrative is not only discursive, but also creates material effects by shaping people's conception of who they are and providing the framework for their action. For the formation of modern Chinese national identity, a particular historical narrative like this is very fundamental. The historical narrative goes like this. Once a great empire, China from the mid-19th century was humiliated by Western forces, becoming a quasi-colony divided into spheres of influence. And poor and weak, China had suffered domestic conflict and foreigner invasion. The period from the late Qin to the Republic was the times of aspiring to become rich, strong, and autonomous, but it was also a period when the country was overwhelmed by setbacks and helplessness. In the late Qin, we know that this kind of discourse or meta, I would say that it's a meta-narrative and an archetypal understanding of national fate and destiny. In the late Qin dynasty and early Republican period, this kind of narrative was gradually constructed by Chinese intellectuals into a collective memory of Chinese national shame. This collective memory about the national shame has functioned as a form of cultural trauma that has a very powerful influence on many generations of Chinese. This historical narrative has been appropriated not only by KMT, but also by the Chinese Communist Party. It is a meta-narrative of modern Chinese nationalism, and it becomes an archetypal understanding of Chinese national fate and destiny, which prevailed among Chinese intellectuals in general, and those devoted to the study of Chinese modernization in particular. Now, for the rest of my presentation, I would like to discuss the case of sociologist Long Guanhai, especially his research about the modernization of Taiwan under the framework of Chinese modernization. But because time is limited, I will not be able to go into the details. Long Guanhai, as one of the founding fathers of Taiwanese sociology, was typical of the first generation exiled mainland scholar. He was born in a village on Hainan Island, Hainan Dao, of southern China in 1906. After studying at a traditional private primary school and then at a Western style one, he made his way to Southeast Asia to live with his uncle, and then received his secondary education in Singapore in early 1920s. In 1923, he was admitted to Tsinghua College, Tsinghua Xuetang in Beijing, which was established for studying in the USA. So after 8 years, he entered the University of Southern California, USC, to study sociology. As many researchers pointed out, the worldview of an individual that influences the rest of his or her life forms in the later adolescence and early adulthood stages. For Long Guanhai, his years at the Tsinghua College and the USC were precisely a period of national disturbance when China suffered domestic and warlord conflicts and Japanese invasion. In response to Japan's aggregation in Northeast China in 1931, not long after his arrival at the USC, Long Guanhai joined a group of Chinese students and immigrants to organize a committee to support the mainland by propagandizing for China. He and some friends also initiated the organization of an alliance character cultivation 人格培养同盟 trying to contribute to trying to contribute to national revival by cultivating Chinese morality, something like this. Longguan has experience of national disturbances in the 1920s and the 1930s, when he was in his late teens and early 20s, had shaped him into an active young man burning with nationalist passion. After receiving his PhD, Long Guanhai returned to China in 1935 and taught at the Department of Sociology, Jinlin Women's University, Jinlin Nizhi Daxue in Nanjing. Before long, like thousands and millions of Chinese people, he was forced to displacement because of the war against Japan and the following civil war between the KMT and the CCP. Eventually, he arrived in Taiwan alone without a company of relatives in 1950 because he secured a professorship at a National Taiwan University, NTU. Just 2 years later, when the Chinese Sociological Association, 中国社会学社, was restored in Taiwan, Long Guanhai became its chairman. As an authoritarian regime, the KMT had long believed that sociology had a close connection with socialism and even communism. But because of their continuing efforts, Long Guanhai and some colleagues at National Taiwan University succeeded in establishing the Department of Sociology in 1960. Serving as the chairman of a National Sociological Association for about a decade and the founding director of the Department of Sociology at the most prestigious university in Taiwan, Long Guanhai and his sociological approach had a very profound influence on a younger generation of sociologists. It did not take him too long to finish his first major book, published in Taiwan, Lectures on Sociology, 社会学讲话. It's published in 1952, that is just 2 years after he arrived in Taiwan. This book demonstrated his deep commitment to his career under a very difficult exile situation. It also became the earliest significant sociological work in post-war Taiwan. But like most exiled Mainlanders intellectuals of his generation, Long Guanhai never abandoned his hope of returning home. In his article, The Status and the Duties of Sociology in China, 社会学在中国的地位与职务, written for the first issue of the National Taiwan University Journal of Sociology in 1963. Long Guanhai emphasized that, quote, "In any case, the prospects of our country's sociology depend entirely on those of our country, and our country's prospects depend entirely on retaking the mainland and eliminating the communist regime. If we guard this treasure island, that is Taiwan, exclusively, we all definitely will have a few prospects," unquote. Long Guanhai's mentality was typical of most exiles, which Edward Said has summed up as living in a median state, neither completely at one with the new setting, nor fully disencumbered of the old, beset with health evolvements and health detachments, unquote. Also, the famous sociologist Hamed Shahidian, he is a He's an Iranian exile in the USA. He describes the exile mentality in a nutshell too. Quote, exile means the painful realization that where you live is and is not home, and that you do and do not live where home is, unquote. The study of Chinese modernization was dominated by the positivist approach. Long Guanhai's works were not an exception. In fact, he was a leading proponent of this approach in Taiwanese sociology. He emphasized that the importance of empirical data, scientific methods, objective and neutral positions, unbiased opinions, journal roles, something like this, and so on. Like many of his fellow scholars in exile, his works were characterized by a series of dichotomies, such as tradition versus modern, China versus the West, communism versus democracy, science versus prejudice, objective versus subjective, sociology of Auguste Comte versus sociology of Karl Marx, something and such like. These dichotomies, together with strong Chinese national consciousness, constituted the cornerstone of his narration about the Chinese social transformation from tradition to modernity. His sociological research, claimed to be objective, neutral, and scientific, was in fact informed with the narrative of identity. This historical narrative, as I have already mentioned, as an archetypal understanding of Chinese national fate and destiny, had prevailed among the exiled social scientists of his generation and the younger generation. It played a major role in their understanding of the connection between their fate as an individual and the fate of the nation as a whole. A sense of historical continuity created by this common narrative helped to support a coherent a collective memory and identity. It contributed to alleviate the exile's uneasy perception of a ruptured life experience existing in a median state. By positioning themselves in this narrative, they found meaning not only in their academic careers, but also in research projects in exile. Nowhere is this narrative more clearly shown than in Long Guanhai's research on the modernization of Taiwan. And we know that Taiwan had been changed dramatically by half a century Japanese colonialism. Its large modernization project about various social, economic, political, and cultural aspects created a significant colonial modernity. A central repeating theme in Long Guanhai's narration about Taiwan is to make sense of the modernization of Taiwan in terms of the Chinese national history. For one thing, the first major challenge of any typical storyteller is to set the temporal beginning point of his or her story, such as long, long ago, or one day when I was 10 years old, something like this. Similarly, in his sociological research, Long Guanhai, as an exile, had to find an appropriate framework of time to place a strange land suspected of being contaminated by foreign colonialism. In addition to his works about a general introduction to sociology, his works and books were focused on topics like population, urban sociology, family, and social problems. Take one of his major research on family change in Taiwan, for example. His article entitled A Research on the Composition of Chinese Family, 中国家庭组织的 一个研究. For example, it was published in 1967, while based on a questionnaire survey of the family conditions of about 900 college and high school students, the research explained the change by placing it in a long plot about the very long transition of Chinese family institution, beginning from the Western Zhou Dynasty, 西周朝代. 龙冠 还 pointed out that ever since the Western Zhou period, China's family institution had undergone many changes, especially after the contact between China and the West, beginning in the late 19th century. He discusses the findings of the survey by placing them in the plot of historical narrative as such, and argued that, quote, the composition of Chinese family in Taiwan, in fact, has not undergone any significant change. It generally still belongs to the traditional Chinese family structure, which can be said to be about the same as the one on the Chinese mainland before it was destroyed by the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. He believed that nuclear families would definitely increase because now China's society, that is Taiwan, was making its transition from an agricultural society to an industrial one. But in fact, to some extent, Long Guanhai understood the significant difference between the Chinese mainland and Taiwan quite well. For example, in his book, China's Population, 中国人口, published in 1955, he openly admired the high quality of the population data collected by the Japanese colonial government. He did not hesitate to recognize that because the Japanese colonial government conducted seven censuses between 1905 and 1940, Taiwan was the only place in China that had ever truly put a modern idea of census into practice. He pointed to the fact that, quote, these are the earliest censuses ever taken in the Far East that relatively meet modern standards. They are regarded by demographers in general as the most valuable data in the regions in the Far East, unquote. Moreover, Long Guanhai once talked about the national moral values promoted by Dr. Sun Yat-sen. He thus emphasized, quote, along the streets across each major city in the national revival base, that is Taiwan, there are no lack of street signs hanging high up with names like blah 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 blah, 忠孝仁爱, 心意和平. However, as far as public hygiene is concerned, everyone says that we have taken steps backward when compared with the Japanese occupation period. There are still people spitting everywhere in public space, something like this, and again, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, okay. As I mentioned already, as a means of giving order and meaning to events, narrative is not simply the reflection of reality. The act of narration gives events a clear beginning, middle, and end, using mechanisms such as election, selection, recombination, simplification, and such like. This is particularly true for political taboo issues. For a narrative about the transition from traditional Taiwan, traditional China to modern China, a story in which Taiwan was positioned as modern China, the Japanese colonial period was a major annoying anomaly which must be explained away in some way or even completely neglected. Although Lung Kuan-hai was pretty aware of the modernization of Taiwan brought about by the Japanese colonialism and even showed his appreciation, in his sociological research about Taiwan along the line of historical narrative already mentioned, he downplayed the importance of Japanese colonialism or just completely ignored it. Take this long article on post-war social change in Taiwan, Republic of China, 1945 to 1969, for example. It was published in English in 1971. This long article gives a very long historical perspective on the social change of Taiwan over the first quarter century after the Second World War. Published about 1 year before Lung Kuan-hai suffered a stroke, this long article is a summary of his experience and observation of the modernization of Taiwan, based on almost his entire professional life in exile. The beginning point of a narrative is always essential to determine for the audience the quality, purpose, and scope of the whole plot. In this article, the beginning point of the modernization of Taiwan can only be dated from 1945, the time when the KMT began to control the island. He argues that most significant social changes had occurred in the four fields: economy, politics, education, and population. The main trend of these changes is from traditionalism to modernization. Based on his positivist view, he was very optimistic about the possibility to control the direction and the process of social changes, and believed that the results brought about were as expected or as predetermined. For him, it was a transition from traditional China to modern China. I think now I don't have time to give more examples, so I will just move on to my conclusion. Narrative or story plays a major role not only in individual socialization, personal identity formation, or collective cultural construction. Many researchers have also pointed out the significance of narration or storytelling in knowledge construction in various disciplines and research areas. Man is a storytelling animal, and the researches in humanities and social sciences are another exception. Their research works are often more informed by historical narratives that function as particular forms of collective memory than they would have admitted. Let me quote political scientist Joshua Dinstock. Based on his analysis of the political theories of John Locke, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Hegel, Dinstock argues, quote, "Political theory, rather than relying on concepts of abstract right and duty, often attempts to guide by giving its readers a particular sense of time. That sense of time persuades not only by logic, but also giving readers a more convincing account of history and of the particular roles they are to play." Political theory speaks to questions of past and the future more often than we are sometimes led to believe. To put it another way, the project of political theory is often not so much to reform our morals as it is to reform our memories. The three decades from the 1960s until the 1980s, that is roughly from Long Guanghai's establishment of the Department of Sociology at the National Taiwan University to his death in 1983, were precisely the period when the historical narrative of Chinese modernization and the cultural trauma dominated public discourse, humanities, and social sciences. Different societies have different ways to think of how they themselves are situated in time, the way in which time and its horizons are imagined is related to the way the society understands and justifies itself. Historical narrative is a major way by which social time is constructed, and in turn, a central discursive mechanism by which people make sense of their fate and destiny. Many mainland social scientists in exile in post-war Taiwan, including Long Guanghai and many scholars of his next generation, had worked hard to narrate Taiwan back into the community of fate of the Chinese nation by positioning it within the horizons of the Chinese nationalist time. However, since the late 1980s, as a result of the rising Taiwanese identity and cultural indigenization, together with political democratization, in general, the major time horizon or framework that dominates a story about Taiwan in public discourse, humanities, and social sciences has been very different. But the analysis of this change has gone beyond the scope of my presentation today, so I will just stop here. Thank you for your patience.